Hello, fellow readers, and welcome to Ravenclaw Readers with me, Claire.
And Ella.
And Paul.
This week, we're examining Chapter 12, The Mirror of Erised, along with the story of Narcissus. There are a few different versions of the Narcissus myth, but the one we're focusing on comes from Book 3 of Metamorphoses, composed by the Roman poet Ovid in the 8th century AD. Ella, do you want to refresh our memories as to what happens in Chapter 12, The Mirror of Erised, please, before I talk about Narcissus?
Okay, so it's now Christmas time, and Harry, Ron and Hermione are busy researching the mysterious Nicholas Flamel, but to no avail. As Hermione leaves for the Christmas holidays, Ron and Harry, who are staying at Hogwarts, promise to continue the search. They are distracted from the task on Christmas Day when Harry unexpectedly receives an invisibility cloak which, according to an anonymous note sent with the cloak, had previously belonged to his father. Later that night, Harry decides to use his new invisibility cloak to gain access to the library's restricted section, but a shrieking book blows his cover and he is forced to make a run for it. He ends up in a disused classroom where he finds a magnificent mirror. Instead of his reflection, the mirror shows Harry his parents and extended family. The following night, Harry returns with Ron, but the mirror shows Ron something completely different, himself as head boy, holding the house and Quidditch cups. Despite Ron's warning not to return, Harry goes back to the mirror room, except this time Dumbledore is waiting for him, with a warning about the dangers of dwelling on one's own impossible dreams.
Oh, I thought I was ready to talk about this chapter, but hearing you summarise it, I'm just like, oh, the emotions is so much. Oh, okay. So just briefly, Narcissus is a young man in the bloom of life, so renowned for his beauty that he has an abundance of lovers and admirers. However, trouble soon comes to Narcissus when one of his scorned lovers calls upon the goddess Nemesis, goddess of vengeance, to punish Narcissus for trifling with people's hearts. The goddess obliges this prayer so that one day, when Narcissus takes a drink from a still woodland pool, he catches a glimpse of his own reflection and instantly falls in love. Narcissus is utterly transfixed by his beauty, yet is horrified by the fact that his love is impossible to realize. Grief turns to utter despair and he begins to beat his chest with fury. This continues until he, quote, dissolves, wasted by his passion, slowly consumed by fires deep within. The water nymphs all mourn the loss of beautiful Narcissus, but when time comes for his funeral, they find no body, but instead, in its place, sits a white-petaled flower encasing a saffron centre. And why this secondary text was chosen? The story of Narcissus felt apt to pair with this chapter, since both tell the tale of unobtainable desire. Now, it may seem unfair to compare Harry to Narcissus, who has rather a shoddy reputation, but in this chapter, Harry faces a similar obstacle to the mythological figure. Both Harry and Narcissus are consumed and obsessed with an image. They fall in love with something that is not and cannot be a reality. What lessons can we learn from their examples? And how important are Dumbledore's words that, quote, it does not do to dwell on dreams and forget to live?
Well, I suppose we could talk about dreams before we get to the mirror, because one of the things I picked up on the Christmas Day bits was that it says it had been Harry's best Christmas Day ever. So I thought for Harry, being at Hogwarts over Christmas is kind of a dream come true, because he's surrounded by friends and a kind of adopted family who seem to love and care for him more than his own family in the form of the Dursleys. And he receives presents that he's never had before, like he gets a Weasley jumper, he can feel part of the Weasley family, and he gets his father's invisibility cloaks as another connection to his parents. And he has a delicious Christmas dinner.
Very important.
Yeah, so it's basically like a dream experience for Harry, who's never had anything like this before.
There's a void there, which is that he's not with his family, or
which Malfoy picks up on. It's one of the first things that happens in the chapter, is Malfoy's trying to find something to tease Harry about, and teasing him about his Quidditch match isn't working because everyone's so impressed by Harry. So he ends up just teasing him about, it says that he doesn't have a proper family. And I think that, yeah, those words, a proper family, like those are the words that the narrator uses, but still, like, purposefully, I think that that's very cutting. You know, and even the letter that he gets from the Dursleys is, oh my gosh, it's like, so he gets a 50p coin that Ron is mesmerized by. And it says his, in this letter, "We received your message and enclose your Christmas present from Uncle Vernon and Aunt Petunia." It's like a formal correspondence. It's almost worse than no gift.
Yeah.
In a way. Yeah, well, this is something I want to think. Like, why do you think that he gets a Christmas present at all from the Dursleys?
Well, it plays a function, which is to remind the reader that Harry is still in communication with the Dursleys and that the Dursleys still don't want him.
Oh, that's so sad. Can you say it like that? I think narratively, for me, it does make sense that he will get a Christmas present from the Dursley. And my, again, I think if we're talking about like canon versus headcanon, this is totally my headcanon, but this is how I think it would work, is that it is absolutely Aunt Petunia who is sending this gift, because she just seems like the type of person that's like, keep up appearances and what do you do at Christmas? It's just like the done thing to send a gift, even if it's like a shoddy little, who knows sometimes what does he get, terrible little trinkets that aren't really proper gifts, but she can like tick that off her list. Is like, okay, well, I've done the expected thing.
It does refer to his card, like, we received your message, so it means that, you know, it shows the importance of that he wants to hold on to, although it's not a proper family, as Malfoy says. It is all he really has, and he doesn't, despite joining the wizarding world, he doesn't turn his back against it completely. He still sends a Christmas message to them. It's an expression of his deepest, darkest desire.
To have a family.
To have a family,
know.
Right?
Yes, yes.
I mean, that's, we see, you know, I think, does Dumbledore say, just quickly discuss the mirror before we discuss everything else. He says that people have been driven mad trying to make what has appeared a reality. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's the danger to Harry, is that he may think that it is possible to resurrect his family somehow via magic. But here we have an instance of him trying to actually make it a reality by, although not by resurrecting his dead parents and grandparents, but by holding on and maintaining the bonds which he has with his existing family, his closest relatives, Aunt Petunia, Dudley, and Pig Boy. And Uncle Vernon.
I think that's why we get so much more emotional resonance, though, when he sees his family in the mirror, because that is still Christmas Day when that happens, which I didn't actually realise until I was closely reading this chapter.
Neither did I!
It's very late on Christmas night, I suppose. And
I'm just thinking ahead again. I keep doing this. I'm thinking to the seventh book. Exactly. I can't help it.
It's just, you know, it's the contrast, isn't it, of like his kind of his sad reality of a family compared to the impossible dream that he'll see later on that day.
It reminds me that just that whole sequence of Christmas Day in Hogwarts reminds me of the Christmas ghost story, which is something we've sort of lost. But of course, like, Charles Dickens' famous A Christmas Carol was written in that tradition of every year people write ghost stories. And
well, we saw the Green Knight that Ella said reminded her of the Christmas present.
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah. Well, that's way back. But I mean, you know, they're very popular in Dickens' time, that's what you do. You publish a Christmas story. And there is that kind of ghostly, floaty, Christmassy...
Christmas magic.
Feast kind of vibe to this sequence.
So when we're talking about family and Harry's desire for a proper family that we see in the mirror, and then his actual reality of the Dursleys, we do see the emergence, as Ella said, about the Weasley family becoming his family, and that Mrs. Weasley sends him that jumper. That's so sweet. That's such a lovely gesture. I like these emerging kind of Harry finding this new family. And at one point Ron says something about you'll be able to see my family any old time when you come visit in the summer. And, you know, it's this really offhand remark. But it's so sweet that, you know, of course Harry's going to come visit. And of course he's going to be kind of part of the family. And, you know, it shows just how easily everyone takes Harry under their wing. And I really liked George in this chapter, because Fred and George come in and they make fun of Percy and they say, oh, put on your jumper, and, you know, tease him as they do. And then George says, you're not sitting with the prefects. Christmas is a time for family. And I thought that was really sweet. And we see that his words kind of mean more than he knows later in the chapter with Harry. But I just thought that was lovely. I was like, yes, it very much is.
The chapter reminds me of when I was in first went to university in Ireland, and the Christmas break came and I lived on campus and everyone left and it was just me and like two of my like close friends, and it did feel like we had the whole campus to ourselves and the whole buildings and things, and it was there was a sad, looking back I suppose there's a sadness to it because you choose not to go home. Like I lived with people I didn't know, and they went, some of them went back, one of them went back every weekend to all his old like friends back in Mayo and stuff.
All the way to Mayo, really?
Yeah, every weekend.
Wow.
And I very rarely went back. I made that choice to stay. And that time you spend with your friends there, it is different. It's special, I suppose. You do feel like your kindred spirits of a sort.
So we've talked about some of the somewhat more positive elements of this chapter. Another thing that I thought was funny, they tell Hagrid their entire plan. And I think that's such a kid thing to do. So they're like, oh, hey, Hagrid, we know that you're not going to tell us more about Nicholas Flamel, but we've been researching him in the library, and they want to show off how smart they are. And I think that is such an 11-year-old kid thing to do. There's no way that like 15-year-old Harry Potter would go around telling Hagrid, this is what I'm up to. But when they're kids, they kind of just want to show off, haha, look, I've outsmarted you, and look how clever we are by doing all our research. And I thought that
absolutely
was very,
but I mean, you actually see that when you say 15-year-old Harry, because by that point they're establishing secrecy with Dumbledore's army, so they totally understand the importance of, you know, keeping your plan a secret by that point.
Does it tell us something about Hagrid that that he's more childlike, that he's not one of the adults?
Yeah.
Despite his enormous stature, he doesn't loom over the children as the other teachers do. Well, he's not a teacher, but you know that they sort of tell them there's no consequences to him knowing. It is almost like a teasing him.
Yeah, they are teasing him a bit, but in a nice way.
Because Hagrid is so kind, you can't dislike the man.
No.
And Malfoy uses him as an insult?
Yeah,
he says, what, you're going to become just another...
He teases Ron about becoming a gamekeeper like Hagrid and says that Hagrid's hut must seem like a palace. Oh my God, these are so mean, these insults. Oh, seriously. God, Draco Malfoy knows how to like cut to the bone. He's definitely got something where he can zone in on what people are insecure about and really needle it. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I think we've talked a little bit about the nice stuff about this chapter. But I think by mentioning the narcissist story, I think I'm inherently suggesting that there is a negativity to this as well, because the narcissist story is it's kind of... tragic and very violent. It's very short. Ovid's little section on narcissists is quite short, but it packs a punch.
You use the word tragic. I think that's important. It's sort of implied that narcissist is aware that it is his reflection, but he continues as if he doesn't know it.
I don't know. I don't know if he ever is aware that it's his reflection. I thought that was part of his punishment, because for Narcissus, it was the goddess who made him fall in love with his reflection as a punishment for the fact that he never gave his love to anybody else, particularly Echo, but also other people who loved him during their life who he just totally ignored. And so they thought, well, if he's not going to share his love, then he's not going to be able to have anything that he ever loves. So I thought that was part of the punishment, was that he would never know that it was himself. He'd just be tormented by somebody who he loved and thought was just constantly out of his grasp.
I read it that he eventually does become aware that it is his reflection, but it doesn't really change the fact that he can't. It's still unobtainable.
Yeah, I think part of its unattainability is part of the fixation on it. So if you, I think in comparing these two chapters, it's I thought to myself, what would Narcissus see in the mirror? Mm. Would he see two versions of himself? Or would he just see himself? I think he would just see himself because he loves himself. He loves the immateriality of the reflection and the unattainability of his himself. If there was two of them, then which one would he be in the reflection? He can't be both, and therefore it's not a love of self.
But it's really interesting because Dumbledore says, when Harry's asking how the mirror works, and he says, if you picture, you know, the happiest man in the world, all he would see was like himself, because he doesn't have to see anything reflected back at him because he's already got everything he wants to be happy. So, but Narcissus isn't particularly content.
Absolutely. I think
so. Would he see himself? Like, I don't know.
I think, well, so what if your desire is something the realization of which would deem it repulsive? So if you had it, it would no longer be desirable.
We're getting very Freudian here, desirable.
Guys. This is getting very deep.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of Narcissus's desire. It's this unchecked sort of sentimental desire for himself.
It's all consuming. It's kind of it's like everything.
So I think it's important to discuss the idea of sentimentality and sincerity. So I think Narcissus's love for himself is a sentimental love as opposed to a sincere love, in that a sentimental love is directed at the self rather than taking the world into account.
To me, what it feels like you're trying to say is Dumbledore's quote, which says, it does not do to dwell on dreams and forget to live, remember that. So I guess the moral of both the stories is that dreams are important and valuable things, but you must never lose sight of reality and what's actually attainable. Because we see both, well, Narcissus in particular, who becomes so obsessed with his reflection that it ends up being to the detriment of everything around him, and he just starts to waste away because he forgets to eat and he doesn't ever want to leave the pool because he always wants to constantly look at his reflection. And we see the beginnings of that in Harry after a couple of nights of going to the mirror. He suddenly starts to thinking, well, what's the point of Nicholas Flamel? I don't even care who he is. Like, I don't even care about Ron. I just want to go and sit with my parents all night. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's already beginning to lose sight of reality, and nothing else really matters to him apart from this impossible dream.
Harry's vision is a sentimental vision.
And you think it being sentimental is a negative thing?
Yes. So he looks out, when he looks out into the actual world, when he looks at Christmas, he sees an absence of his family. So Christmas is marked by the absence of his family. His detailing of the outer world is emphasis is a truth about himself, this truth of this, you know, of his personality, his desire. The mirror fills that void at the expense of the entire world. He's only interested in, like you say, he compulsively returns to the mirror to look at this. Just as Narcissus is, he only evokes the outer world to say, is there anyone out there whose love is as dire and my situation is as dire as mine? So I have a quote here regarding sincerity and sentimentality, which is, sincere expression coincides with an attention to and realization of attendant circumstances, or that a sentimental emotion is one that outruns the control of any justifying thought. But to answer your original question, is this tragic?
That is an original question.
So this is what I'm trying to answer. Harry Potter's feelings is sentimental, but Rowling's depiction of the scene is not. Mm-hmm. So Harry, through noble motive, could potentially bring about his ruin by trying to resurrect his family. This fixation on the image, just as Narcissus brings about his own ruin. And that is tragic. So G.K. Chesterton, talking about Dickens, says that there's, in the whole works of Dickens, there is only one tragic character, which is in Bleak House and Richard Carston, because it is through noble endeavors that he brings about his own ruin. And for G.K. Chesterton, that's what tragedy is. Mm-hmm. And here we could see Harry's, you know, he means well, but he could bring about his ruin. Now, interestingly, compare that to Ron's vision, which is, so Harry doesn't know how to bring about, how to realize his vision. There's an impossibility in it, just as Narcissus's love for himself is impossible because it's himself and his reflection. But Ron's vision or his dream to be respected head boy, he doesn't. The way to make that real is not through some unknown means, but through his brothers, through his peers and things like that. So he has to look into the outer world in order to make his dreams realizable. And he doesn't want to return to the mirror. He sees the danger that Harry faces. And I think that's an interesting distinction.
So, yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about, what Ron sees in the mirror, because, yeah, he sees himself as head boy and he's won the Quidditch Cup and he's achieved everything and more that his brothers have achieved. And I guess it's kind of easy to read. And I think in the past I have read this chapter like this and see what Harry sees in the mirror is so deep and painful and like beautiful, but terribly sad. And Ron seems almost superficial compared to that when you just read it, you know, oh, he just wants popularity and, you know, to be, you know, social rank. But I think that that is probably an unfair reading of Ron. I don't know. What do you think, Ella? Do you think that Ron sees is superficial, or do you think there's a depth to it?
I think it's maybe kind of halfway in between, because compared to Harry, who sees his family and there's this kind of really deep emotional connection to what he's seeing, something really profound, Ron's does sort of pale in comparison to that. But then it, unlike Harry's impossible dream, Ron's dream is actually attainable.
Right. Yeah,
see some of that. So, you know, the Gryffindor house does win the House Cup. They do win the Quidditch Cup, and he might not become head boy, but Ron does become a prefect. So we do see some of that coming to fruition of what he wants from his life, which I think perhaps because it is an attainable dream, it doesn't seem as tragic or as compelling as Harry's, because we know that Harry can't have that, and it's devastating to us as readers because we just want him to be able to experience that family.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I think it's Dumbledore says that you gain neither truth nor knowledge can come from the mirror, other than obviously the knowledge of your desire, but that's neither here nor there. I suppose that's anyway. But
is he saying that knowledge is not a truth
because it comes from? It's not. Yeah. It's. Yeah, perhaps. You could make the argument that truth and knowledge, like, comes from the outer world rather than the inner world. And Ron does not gain the knowledge about how to achieve his desires, as I said, from the mirror, but through the institutions in which he lives. So, strangely enough, it's by fulfilling his desires, Ron's desires, he fulfills Harry's wish in a way, because in doing so, a byproduct of him looking up to his brothers is that he respects them and that he reinforces these family bonds. And this does not come from the mirror. This comes from the real world and his knowledge to do so. So I don't think his desire is superficial. Bear in mind now, he's
like 11-year-old boy. Yeah.
I think we're so in awe of the profundity of Harry's,
yes,
that any, you know, most people's would seem perhaps less profound. But I think it's often the, you know, I've recently spent a lot of time with my 90-year-old grandmother, and she is very simple in a way, but there's a great profundity to the way in which she leads her life, which is one which focuses on responsibility to your family. And it's when I was a teenager, I thought she was, you know, it was simple and she was an uncomplicated woman. But I see now that, like, she is a role model. If I follow in her footsteps, I can have a deep and meaningful life with my family and friends.
Yeah, because it's still so young, but those could be the impulses behind what he sees, even if he yet doesn't understand them, whereas Harry's are very, very different.
It goes back to that question of ends and means. Well, Ron, you see, well, in both instances, you see the end.
Being a boy, being having Quidditch Cup. Yeah,
but the means in achieving that has a positive outcome, whilst the means of Harry's, well, there's no means. It's impossible. It's a dream which he can only experience whilst dreaming. But to answer that interesting point about the happiest man, so I mean, I have spoke of sincerity and sentimentality, but you could some people would argue that sincerity is just a matter of correspondence between inner and outer expression. So you get the idea that like a good poem is like one that really, you know, expresses my inner feelings and stuff like that, which is not necessarily. I wouldn't agree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we say Shakespeare is a genius not because he expressed his own personal feelings, but because he represented the whole gestalt or gamut of human experience.
Yes.
So there's this idea that so if you take sincerity as that correspondence between inner and outer expression, then the mirror just becomes a sort of sincerity machine. Like it is sincerity itself. But then, of course, someone's desires, there is no, a man with no desires is not a happy man. There is no such, I would.
So the happiest man in the world that Dumbledore speaks of, it doesn't exist.
The only person who would see their own reflection in the mirror of Erised is Narcissus.
Guys, we haven't even talked about the cloak. Oh my God. Well, I think that the cloak and the mirror are inherently like linked. So we have these two devices that seem to speak to one another in a strange dialogue. And of course, the link between the cloak and the mirror for Harry's point of view is his family. Mm-hmm. And we know, spoilers, Paul, but I'm sure you've already figured it out. Dumbledore is the one that sent Harry the cloak. And
well, duh.
he says in the letter, it is time I returned it to you. So it is an acknowledgement that this is something that doesn't belong to Dumbledore and that it has always belonged to Harry, even if Harry didn't know it and was never even aware of it, because it was his father's. And as we will find out, it goes back further in his family history. And he's told to use it well. And these words echo around in his head when he's tries on the cloak for the first time to sneak around Hogwarts and mm-hmm. sneak into the restricted section to find out about Nicholas Flamel. And those that idea of use it well, corresponding with Dumbledore's advice of do not dwell on dreams. Like, Dumbledore's given a lot of advice in this chapter. I mean, it's been so strange, Harry not having his invisibility cloak. I was saying in the Midnight Duel chapter, when we were just talking about it amongst ourselves, I was saying, it's so weird. I kept thinking, why doesn't he just throw on the cloak? And, oh, he doesn't have it yet. It's just because it's almost an extension of him, right? Like, he becomes, it's so much a part of him and how he gets around Hogwarts and how he navigates. As well, later with the Marauder's Map, but, you know, that a little bit less so just because it's introduced later in the series. Mm. I don't know, so I'm wondering if, you know, so this cloak is something that can be used well. It can be used for ill, but it can be used well. But the mirror of Erised is something that, in this chapter, doesn't seem really like it can be used well, or at least the way that Harry's using it now is not how to use it well. And it comes back around later in the final few chapters of this book that the mirror can be used well, but Harry does not yet know how to use it.
The mirror,
yeah. Oh, you just wait, Paul.
How?
You just wait.
I suppose the cloak does facilitate the realization of his desires, like you say. So like he,
so it comes from his family.
He wants to brings him to his family. Go into this restricted zone.
Mm-hmm.
He has this desire to do so, and he has this moment of excitement where all of a sudden he realizes it is now possible.
All of Hogwarts was open to him. It's such a magical idea.
But even at the start, I thought it was quite nice when he put on the cloak first.
Mm.
The first thing he did was look in the mirror because he desired to see himself invisible.
Yes.
Which is quite interesting. Well, it plays with that idea of desire and the reflection and stuff. But I just like that idea of looking at yourself. Because that's exactly what I would do. I'd go straight to a mirror and look at myself or lack of myself.
But it does seem from the get-go, once Harry does stumble across the mirror, that when he figures out how it works, in that he realizes that there's no one else in the room. He sees who he realizes in a few minutes is his mother, but he says, you know, there's this woman standing there, and she and the others only existed in the mirror. And I think that was just such a sad sentence. And then it's after that he realizes that it's his family. So Harry is aware pretty much from the get-go that this thing is unobtainable. But do you think that Dumbledore is right to kind of warn him?
I was definitely reading Dumbledore's warning to Harry in contrast with the story of Narcissus, and particularly the contrast between Dumbledore and Echo. So Echo is a nymph who falls in love with Narcissus, but she can't convey her love because fate has decreed that she can only repeat back the words of others. She can't really express herself by herself. And she fails to tell Narcissus about her love, and he rejects her, and then she sort of wastes away pining for him. And then later she is brought back to watch him as he himself wastes away pining for his own reflection. And I kind of thought that Dumbledore's almost like a reverse Echo, because he is able to warn Harry about the dangers of pining after impossible dreams. And would Narcissus have been saved from his fate if Echo had been able to act like Dumbledore does to Harry, if she'd been able to step in and say, you can't do this, you will die? And that's just, I just sort of read it like that, how it's a kind of a tragic parallel of that Harry could very easily have become Narcissus if he didn't have Dumbledore there to warn him.
I think I'm getting a deeper respect for Dumbledore. Like, I've always liked Dumbledore's character, and I know that I'm definitely not like a complete Dumbledore apologist, and I do recognize that, you know, he's a grayer character than he initially appears, and I love that. I think that's great. But I do really find, like, this chapter, the way it, we were saying, this is so strange that this is Harry's first meaningful interaction with Dumbledore. Like, how crazy is it, this far into the book? Like, this is the first time they've seen each other since Harry was a baby, and Harry doesn't remember that. And I really do think the way that Dumbledore approaches it, it's actually a really short bit at the end of the chapter, but it is so perfect. And the way he sits down on the floor next to Harry, and like does all these things that, you know, connects with him in a way that maybe other adults haven't really connected with Harry before. Even ones that Harry loves, like Hagrid, or, you know, respects, like Professor McGonagall. And part of that is, again, Paul's at a bit of a disadvantage, but when we know more about Dumbledore, we can see that, you know, possibly Dumbledore is reading a lot of his own experiences into what Harry is seeing.
This chapter teaches us an important limitation on magic, which magic can be used to fulfill your desires, as we've seen with the magic cloak, which Harry learns again. But there is a limit to what it can achieve. It cannot bring people back from the dead, and it cannot prevent death, and it cannot change the past. Is there time travel in the later books? I don't know. There
is, but it is very limited in what it can do. We're not counting Cursed Child as canon, guys, remember? The whole thing about in the Harry Potter book series, I'm choosing my words carefully, time travel exists, but you can't change the past. It's a loop. What has happened will always have happened.
Magic seems like this strange mix between, like, love and power, because it...
my God, Paul, the two, like, main themes of Harry Potter here.
Because you can use it to realize your goals. And in a sense, it's still, because it's not unbounded, it also sort of sets those goals. Like, you can't, your goal can't be to raise the dead, for instance, or to do something impossible. But it also, I suppose, the danger of it is that, why can't it be used to raise the dead?
I think with, like, raising the dead and with immortality, the thing about magic is that you can actually do these things, but you shouldn't, because there are lots of repercussions to it, and ultimately achieving that will just bring you more pain than if you hadn't mm-hmm. done it at all. So it's, you know, just because you can doesn't mean you should. Mm. It definitely applies to really profound issues like that.
In the narcissist story, is narcissist realizes that he can't obtain his reflection in the pool, and he says, "So very small a thing it is that keeps us from our loving." And that just reminded me of this, you know, when something is so close and yet so far. And I think that despite the differences in the narcissist and Harry's circumstances of what they see reflected back at them, maybe Harry feels something like that. The image of his parents and his family and what he just craves more than anything is so close that he can almost touch it, but he can't.
You said about narcissists saying that. What was the line?
So very small a thing it is that keeps us from our loving.
That's what makes it so engrossing. Mm. It's tantalizing.
That's why Harry gets so obsessed.
It's like a fantasy object which looms a lot. It is like internet addiction or social media addiction in a way, because you're always on the, with social media and stuff, you're always run the risk of actually achieving something, but you never do. Because it's immaterial.
So I think that it's true in that, in a way, yes, the image that Harry sees is like a fantasy object. And it says here, this is what it says of narcissist's situation. That image of an image without substance arrives with you, and with you it remains. And it will leave when you leave, if you can. So that's the taunting of narcissists. Mm-hmm. And I think Harry feels that taunting of the image, but the image represents more than an image. For narcissists, it's an image of an image, so it's the image of his image. There's nothing really there. There's no base. But with Harry, again, it sounds kind of corny, but it's not an image of an image. It's an image of something real, and that reality is love. And he can take that with him and bring it into the real world. But, I mean, he can't take his family because they're dead. But he can take what that image stands for and bring it into the real world and, you know, be part of the Weasley family and carry that with him as he goes on.
We've all been in a situation where you need to do something. It might be write an essay, it might clean your house or something, but you end up, like, on a loop watching YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is what the modern day narcissist situation. It would end if all you could do is walk away from it, and you know that, but you continue watching, and that makes it worse, because you know, and you can't walk away. It's like an addiction.
Yeah, the magic. I like the magic mirror being a very a staple of fairy tales and mythology and lore. I mean, even think about like Disney films that are, you know, based on
Mirror on the wall.
Mirror on the wall. Yeah, the Snow White and Beauty and the Beast as a magic mirror shows. Yeah, it's a world.
Even in the Matrix, they go into a mirror.
Do they?
When Neo takes the pill, he touches a mirror, and that's when he goes through.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I mean, so clearly, like, Rowling is drawing on this symbol. Tradition, yeah.
It's like a movement, an internal movement almost, passing through the mirror, because it represents like something which has gone inside your mind, because you are the same, but you have changed somehow. You have confronted yourself and had an epiphany or realization or something.
I'm wondering this. You say it goes inside your mind, but this mirror shows, I mean, Dumbledore says it can show not knowledge or truth, but it does show some kind of truth, because as we have established, Harry doesn't know what his parents look like. He doesn't know what his family looks like, definitely.
It definitely gives a precision to our desires that our language can't.
But he sees his mother crying. Like, she's smiling and she's happy, but she's crying. And then his father puts his arm around her to comfort her. If Harry really wanted to see his deepest desire, would his mother be crying?
But you see, the thing is as well, his mirror parents act in the same way as they do in the wizard pictures, wizard photos that Harry has of them.
But he doesn't have them yet, though, does he?
He doesn't. He will get them. Yeah. But I thought there must be some element of truth to the mirror image because they are exactly the same in every other format we see them in, which is, you know, in pictures.
In pictures or in the Resurrection Stone. Oh, guys, I thought this chapter was rough. The Resurrection Stone chapter is going to get me in the seventh book. I'm not even ready to talk about that.
And in the Goblet of Fire as well.
Oh, yes.
When we see the ghost figures appear out of the wands.
Stop, I can't do it.
Yeah, they are fundamentally recognizably the same in all of these different mediums that we see them in.
What makes the mirror so enticing is that how real it is. So it has to be as real as possible. Otherwise, it's not. It doesn't fulfill that fantasy desire. It must like be as real and gross as possible. And it does that. It's not just his parents, it's his grandparents and everything else. And
family.
They're crying.
Yeah.
So that's it's almost as if they're real looking down at him from heaven or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's it doesn't mean that the mirror is showing him a truth. Really, it's just showing him a very convincing lie. Socks. Does Dumbledore see socks?
I can't go on to socks from just what we were talking about, but then again, Dumbledore does. Okay, if Dumbledore can do it, I'm gonna have to do it too. What do you make of this line about him seeing socks?
Well, I've never believed that he's seen socks.
No, Harry doesn't either. Harry doesn't
buy it. No, no. But I've never been sure of what it is he does see. And my idea of what he does see was only really formed when we get more of Dumbledore's backstory in the Deathly Hallows. Mm-hmm. But also, again, I know we talked about it in our canon episode about how things outside the books, can they influence how you perceive the books? Mm-hmm. And I now can't unsee what Dumbledore sees in the Mirror of Erised in Fantastic Beasts 2.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I'm now thinking, ooh, so does that mean he's seeing Grindelwald in the mirror? I don't know. I feel like that could be supported by what we see in the seventh book as well. Mm-hmm. Although that wasn't what I thought he saw, if you get me. Yeah, I really don't know what Dumbledore sees.
Well, we know that what you see in the mirror can change. So even whether or not you want to regard what happens in Fantastic Beasts as like canon or whatever, I mean, it's still possible that it could change. I don't know. I always felt like it had something to do with his family.
With Ariana in particular, I always thought.
Who?
Sorry, Paul is so lost here. Paul, okay, you don't really know anything about Dumbledore's history. What do you think the socks... Why does he say socks?
Well, for one thing, it teaches Harry a lesson. Well, so we know what Harry's desire is throughout the book. It's sort of fed to us on a magic spoon, like that family is his deepest, darkest desire. And he expresses
it. I don't think that ever changes either.
But here it teaches Harry that what people want is not necessary. They're not willing to reveal what they actually desire. Mm. And this, that's a much more, it's a nuanced adult sort of realization, right? It's sort of similar to that realization where you realize your parents aren't that they're lied to you, that they don't know everything. But I think Dumbledore's vision, even if it's not true, it is maybe revealing, because his wish is not for something, it's to change the way people think about him. He says everyone thinks I want books, but his desire is to get socks. What would you see in the mirror?
Oh my god. I have absolutely no idea what I'd see in the mirror.
That's what Paul was saying, is like, would you not be some, like, what if your deepest desire is something that you are horrified by and you're like, oh my god, is that me?
I'm so worried that I would look into the mirror and see something which is unattainable, almost by definition impossible, because that I don't know if I would have the strength not to either walk away from the mirror or try to make it a reality. And I'm terrified of that loop or that way lies madness. I do believe that. I'm too scared to look into the mirror. I wouldn't do it. Also, desires change all the time.
I think...
But I suppose I worried that the thing that I really want is failure. To not succeed.
Mm.
And I worry about that.
I definitely can think of what I probably would have wanted when I was a teenager. And it would be very different to what I think I'd see now. And it I'm pretty sure I know what I would have seen when I was a teenager, and it makes me really upset. I just think that, like, my deepest desire when I was a teenager was just like, I'm pretty sure, like, I don't know, maybe part of me is like, oh, but it was your deepest desire, it would be something deep and meaningful, like, you know, what Harry sees. But I don't think so. I think, yeah, what I would have seen as a teenager would just be just like something that I feel sad for myself that I would have desired that thing. I don't know. I think I would look in the mirror. Paul says he wasn't. I don't know. Ella, would you look in the mirror, do you think?
I don't know. Again, I don't know what I'd see. I don't know if I'd even want to look. Yeah, it's like that. You know, like if somebody told you, I can tell you exactly when and how you're going to die, would you want to know, or would you just want to carry on living? Because what if they said, oh, you're going to die in a year's time, would you then, you know, want to be able to make the most of your life for that year, or would you rather just not know at all and just carry on?
Very quickly, though, I just want to say that here we see again a basis of magic objects, that they sort of respond to inward feelings in a strange way. So the broom responds to Harry's bravery, the wand responds to Ron's fear when he wants to kill the troll thing, and here we have the mirror of backwards desire responding to inward feelings of desires. So it seems to be a recurring mechanism. And then I'm still pushing the idea that dark magic then is tries to change that expression somehow, to obfuscate that expression. I don't know. Alters the expression, makes your broom freak out, or change someone's desires. I don't know.
We didn't have a quote. Does anyone have a quote they want to end on?
I already mentioned my quote, which was the whole kind of it doesn't do to dwell on dreams bit. So I've already said that. So somebody else has got another quote.
So this is Roger Scruton on fantasy and imagination. So it's perhaps important to say that he makes the distinction between fantasy and imagination. Which is the fantasy object, which is perhaps what you see in the mirror, intrudes into the real world. It is an unreal object of actual desire, condemned to unreality by the mental prohibition that also summons it. The fantasy object must be as real as possible in order to provide the surrogate for what which the subject craves. Fantasy covets the gross, the explicit, the no-holds-barred display of the unattainable, and in the crisis of display, the unattainable is vicariously obtained.
You think that what Harry sees is inherently
sentimental, that it's a fantasy object.
Yeah, I think that Harry, with Dumbledore's instruction and with Dumbledore's guidance, can take the goodness from what he's seen. The love.
No, I think that's true, and I think that's why your point about Echo is such an interesting one, that Dumbledore is the reverse Echo in a sense, because he instructs, as a teacher should, Harry how to feel. He provides the knowledge about how to feel about this reflection, which Harry wouldn't reflect on that reflection if it wasn't for Dumbledore's suggestion to reflect.
I mean, I had one potential final point. We've talked a lot here at Ravenclaw Readers about the significance of names, to the extent that we've even thought we might have a footnotes episode on it. But I thought, like, what we see here is a very direct linguistic parallel to Narcissus in Narcissa, Malfoy's mother. And
that's Draco Malfoy's mother. We'll meet her at
Draco
some
Malfoy's
point.
Mom, yeah.
God, not for ages though.
Not for a long time.
Goodness, that's like the fourth book or something insane anyway.
But I thought it can, you know, can we draw any significance from this particular parallel? Because of course Narcissus is also a flower, and there are a lot of flower names in Harry Potter. But was the name Narcissa chosen because of the flower or because of Narcissus?
Yeah, I think that we can definitely dig into that because I was thinking.
Should we do a names one?
We're gonna have to.
Let's do a names one.
What's her mom's name again?
Lily.
Lily, and then Petunia.
Petunia. Yeah.
Boy, you need to at least know the basics. Lily and James are the names of his parents, okay?
And it's Harry, Ron, and...
Stop.
Well, thank you very much for listening, everybody. And we'd like to know your thoughts because we have got a few emails and messages from people and it's so lovely. Email us at ravenclawreaderspod@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at ravenclawreaders. And as well, you can always look at our website for any of the show notes or talking about the secondary text, and that's just ravenclawreaders.com. Next week, we will be looking at chapter 13, Nicholas Flamel, and we will be reading another extract from William Shakespeare's Hamlet. We'll be looking at Act 1, Scene 5, which is the scene in which Hamlet meets his father's ghost.
Bye!
So the magic of the mirror is really strange, right? Because
it does show your face. What if you got a mirror and held it up to the mirror?
Stop trying to trick it.